Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audio biography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is a professor at Rutgers University, Newark, and an award-winning journalist. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Kim Ann Curtin, known as the Wall Street Coach, has written a book called Transforming Wall Street, A Conscious Path for a New Future, a book she hopes will launch an ethical movement in the financial world. And she poses some provocative questions. Can you work on Wall Street without selling your soul? Is it possible that there are more decent people working on Wall Street than there are wolves? We'll get some of the answers she received from the dozens of people she interviewed in her book, prominent men and women in the financial district, along with professors, teachers, and religious figures. Kim Ann, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to hear what you found out, but first, everybody wants to know who you are. So tell us, what in the world is a Wall Street coach?
What the Wall Street coach is a moniker that was given to me about 6.5, 7 years ago when I gave my coaching away downtown outside of the stock exchange. I had become an executive coach. I'm a certified executive coach and consultant. And I had not created a niche, if you will. Most times when you become an executive coach, they tell you to niche yourself, you know, find a specific group of people you want to do your work with. And I had not done that. But after that unusual adventure that I had, I was called the Wall Street Coach by some reporters and journalists that covered the story. And because I had worked in finance for 10 years previous to that, I ran with it. And I thought, that's a great name. That's a great domain. So that's the name of my firm. Of course, people affiliate that with me now, but it really, I am an executive coach. And my specialty is working with people in the finance world.
Who'd you work for?
I worked for two hedge funds prior to becoming an executive coach. I was an executive and personal assistant to the CEOs, respectively.
And prior, of what companies?
King Street Capital and Second Curve Capital. Those were the two hedge funds I worked for. Before that, my first position in finance and banking was for Community Bankers Association of New York State. And that was a collection of community bankers, the what I like to say are the George Baileys of banking.
And the George Baileys of banking?
Yeah.
What's that? Who is that?
George Bailey is a character from It's a Wonderful Life, and it's one of my favorite movies, and it's a movie I grew up on and watched every Christmas and had a huge impact on me. I think the question...
James Stewart.
Yep, Frank Capra's movie with Jimmy Stewart, who plays the character George Bailey.
We have to go back. It's October 2008. You're sitting there as if you're a Lucy from Peanuts, right?
Absolutely.
And people start coming over to you and they begin talking. Goodness, why were they talking to you and why would they talk to you?
I think that day they would have talked to a lamppost because it happened to be October 7th, 2008. And that day the market dropped almost 500 points. Unexpectedly, I had already chosen to sit down there because I had found myself a year and a half into my business struggling, putting groceries on my credit cards, and I was scared. I left a very lucrative position to do what I felt was my bliss. You know, Joseph Campbell was somebody I had admired my whole life, and he talked about finding your bliss. I found my bliss finally, and year and a half into my bliss, I was not paying my rent.
Blissful.
I was like, this is not blissful. What's going on? I'm doing what I was born to do now. But what happened is it started out strong, certainly wasn't making what I had made at the hedge fund, but I was doing just fine initially. And then that summer of 08, you know, without a lot of us knowing what was happening, people began to stop spending. And coaching is still seen a bit as a luxury. And that was one of the first things people cut. And when that happened, I, you know, talked to some friends about it, just crying, what am I going to do? And they said, you know, if you're meant to do this, then do it, give it away for free and take some, you know, temp work, start doing something on the side to get some revenue. And so I thought, okay, where would I give this? Who needs this the most? And I just kept thinking, when I had worked in finance, things were going well financially for them. And yet it was still extraordinarily tense every day. And I thought, God, what? That must be awful now, because now they're not in a good situation. They must be really stressed out. I think my coaching would be of value down there. So I came from this place of, I'll go and, you know, be a contribution. This, I'll give this away. I get to do what I know I have to do. And maybe I bring some value, and maybe I meet some new prospects.
And the person you're working for asked, what were you doing out there? And he needed a coach too, right?
I had already left my position. So I was already working, had my own business already a year and a half. And initially had clients. I had 8 paying clients, you know, very early on in my starting that business. But once that summer of 08 came, a year and a half into it, I thought, wait a minute, this is, I have to come up with something else. So when I was down there, there was nobody to answer to but me, because I was, you know, the entrepreneur, but the entrepreneur whose bright idea wasn't going as smooth as I thought. And they say 3 years is what you need as an entrepreneur. And here I was a year and a half into it, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
Lucy in the Peanuts cartoon charges a nickel. You weren't charging anything, were you?
I wasn't charging anything.
You were described in one article that I read as saying that you're a neutral sounding board, an advisor on people and how they're managing their life professionally and personally, acting like a cobweb all connected. Is that accurate? Is that accurate?
Somewhat.
Somewhat.
I mean, yes, it is. And the cobweb speaks to who we are professionally. We can't separate who we are personally from how we show up professionally. So I just want to give clarity to that cobweb piece.
Okay. Well, what kind of personal problems do these people have? Who are they?
They are usually very successful by society standards.
Really?
Yes. Coaching is really not used to fix people. It's used to make somebody become even more of who they are. Somebody who has a lot of, let's just say narcissism, for example, they would never come to coaching because, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. So this is the kind of work that somebody says, I'm good, but I want to be great. I want to make myself even more emotionally intelligent with the conversations I have with people professionally and personally.
I don't mean to be disrespectful, but you sound like a shrink.
I would agree. I think a lot of people think it's like a shrink.
Without a license.
That's the distinction. The difference between coaching and having a psychologist or a psychiatrist is the model receives you as whole. In coaching, we receive our clients naturally creative, resourceful, and whole. You're not broken. You don't need fixing. The behaviors that may be costly to you, that are not working, are behaviors that at one point in your life served you, helped you navigate difficult terrain, and they work then, but they're not working now.
Describe a typical client. I don't know if I can call them a client, patient, whatever you want to call them.
Client.
They're clients. They're making, I don't know, $500,000 a year, but they've got to see Kim Ann Curtin. Why? What's wrong with them?
Nothing's wrong, but what they see is that I don't think any of us can see ourselves without having an observer. We're not, as Simon Garfunkel ever said, you know, no man is in an island. You know, you have to have some kind of a sounding board. Most of us, and especially if you're a C-suite level executive,
C-suite, chief executive officer, chief
executive officer, CEO, it could be CFO, COO, anybody who is leading organization.
A C-suite, S-U-I-T-E, someone who's up there way up high in a corner office somewhere.
Yes.
Okay.
We have those people at that level usually have a lot of yes men or yes women around them. People who tell them, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, you're doing great. Yeah, everybody loves you. And that's not necessarily the truth. And the hard truth, when you can't have an agenda. That's the distinction. When you have an effective, coach is somebody who's willing to speak the hard truths, not because they have an agenda. The agenda gets set by the client. That's what's so distinct between psychology. The psychologist sets the agenda when you go into therapy. And I'm not dismissing therapy. I think it's fantastic and it's important, but it's a different model than coaching. Coaching holds the client as resourceful and whole, and they get to set the agenda. The coach is there to make sure that they hold true to that agenda and that the goals they set for themselves is going to, that they're going to get there.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. Our guest is Kim Ann Curtin, known to her followers, I can call them followers? Yeah, I guess so, as the Wall Street Coach, whose new book, Transforming Wall Street, A Conscious Path for a New Future, I want to ask about that, is an attempt to make Wall Street, anybody can do it, boy, that would really be a great job, more ethical, a difficult task indeed. And so you went out and you collected all these people all over the place and they began talking to you. Why would they talk to you?
I think at that time, the reason they spoke to me was because they were very traumatized by the crash of the market. You know, when you are seeing everything you've worked so hard at just kind of come tumbling down, I don't think my having people talk to me then would have happened had that crash not occurred, because I probably looked like somebody who was, you know, we know New Yorkers, sometimes there's crazy people out there. I had a really nice suit on, so that counteracted my homemade sign. But I think under normal circumstances, probably I wouldn't have been approached. I think they were approaching me that day because they were traumatized. They were completely in shock what had just happened with that free fall. And I think they just needed somebody to talk to. Over the weeks, because I went and did this for a year.
Once a week.
Almost once a week at lunchtime. I'd go at lunch hours, you know, for an hour or two.
They could afford to buy food then.
They could afford to buy food. And I wasn't just coaching Wall Streeters. I was coaching bike messengers. I was coaching secretaries, anybody who stopped. I didn't say, you know, I just was coaching anybody who sat down, anybody who wanted to talk.
How about your book?
My book came out of my belief that there are more men and women on Wall Street who have integrity than do not. I felt we had put so much focus for these last few years on what we don't want, and I thought it was time for us to talk about what we do want. And one of the things I always look to are mentors or role models, and I realized that we didn't really have them for this community. We all know who the bad guys are, but I wondered, why don't we know the names of the good guys? Why don't we know the names of those who had been challenged and had rose above the challenges? I heard myself saying to, you know, different people, somebody ought to find the good guys of Wall Street. Somebody ought to find the good guys. So we have poster children, if you will.
A good guy?
You know, it's relative, right? And what I think is a good guy may be different than what you think.
I want to know what you think. You're more important than me. Come on.
Well, it's somebody who strives to live with integrity, somebody who has a sense that their actions has an impact on other people or their inaction. You know, there's qualities, I guess, that you could say are people. There are people in our life who we can shake their hand, and we know that that means they're going to be a man or woman of their word. We don't need a 70-page contract. I like people who are like that. And I just thought, I want to know who those people are and for the world to know, because I had worked in finance and knew such great people, knew such men and women of integrity, I felt like they're all being, kind of painted with a wide brush now. And the jokes that I was hearing and the commentary and walking through Occupy, I saw a sign. Occupy Wall Street. I, because of having done the free coaching for a year, I knew that neighborhood really well. And so when Occupy started, I went down and walked through it to get a feel for it. And I was struck with how that very park, I had volunteered downtown after 9/11 and I had worked, and I was so touched at the man's generosity to his strangers. Like people across the country had driven in to donate their chiropractic services, and just there was so much selflessness. after 9/11. And I was so, I saw all this love. And there was the same park when I walked through it for Occupy. And I heard nothing. I said, my God, this is the same park where the people were so selfless and giving of each other. And now we have these people who are otherizing and make hatred signs. And, you know, there was a picture of a man in a suit lynched from a tree. And I was like, and even God hates Wall Street. And these were the signs I saw. And I thought, God, these people that I'm friends with, that I care about, that I know are good people, are walking past this every day. How must I feel for them?
But there, but Wall Street was driven into the ground.
Yes.
By lots of the people who the young men and women on Occupied Wall Street were upset about. They were, I think one of the people you interviewed, Frank, was it Frank Casey? Is that his name?
Yes.
Who tried for years to try to get the government to pay attention to someone named Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff was one of the worst swindlers, I guess you call him swindler,
yeah,
con men.
I think so.
And he couldn't get anybody to pay attention to what he was saying. That guy's a bad guy.
I think what...
That's what most people were seeing, by the way.
I think most people were seeing the Bernie Madoffs, but
right.
I thought, wow, if we had had more attention paid to Frank Casey from the very beginning, or Harry Markopoulos, or Neil Cello, all of those three gentlemen who took this cause on...
And your fellow, that fellow Harry... told Congress how it should fire the top three, the top third of the SEC, the
yes,
Security Exchange Commission. Nobody was fired.
I agree. It's a horror. And I am not denying these horrors, and I am not denying that there isn't serious issues.
How are you going to get them to pay attention to your book, to what you're asking? You want people to have a conscience. Is that right?
I do.
And you want them to think about other people beside themselves, right?
Yes.
How do you get people whose job it is just to make money to think about other people who don't make as much money as they do?
You do it first by teaching them that the way money is made is when you have a long tail perspective. If you want to stay in business for more than just a short period of time, you have to really think about the impact it's going to have on all the stakeholders, not just your shareholders. We have a very short window right now. It's just a grab. Just grab what you can as quick as possible, and then the hell with the rest. But that comes from, you know, unfortunately, this primacy on shareholder value that, you know, by the way, is a mistake. You know, this Milton Friedman and company misunderstood what that mandates. And Lynn Stout, one of the professors in my book, identifies the fact that shareholder primacy is what has gotten us into trouble for the last 30 years.
Wall Street is supposed to provide access to small business instead of access to traders with a computer, right? Am I right or wrong?
I don't know that it's a yes or no.
Simplistic. I know I'm simplistic.
And I understand exactly what you're saying, and I can appreciate that. What it comes down to is, how do we begin to change the whole system?
Who's the most ethical person you spoke to in this book? I spent approximately 35 hours going through your books. I want to get something out of this.
I think all these 50 are ethical people. I think they're all striving. Wall Street 50. I call these Wall Street 50 are the 50 men and women that I interviewed that I feel are showing us what integrity looks like, are living by their own moral code, who are trying and striving to live a life that is one of integrity and consciousness.
The best one. The one you had the most fun interviewing. Let's not get into trouble, but you know.
I had a lot of fun with all of them. I'm just trying to think like one that I can
take a minute
point out. Who is? I can't say he's my favorite, because it's like asking me what child is my favorite. Like, you know, you don't ask a woman who's your favorite child. They're all, I love them all. I think I was really struck by Frank Casey. I think
who was running around the country telling everybody to be honest. Hey, well, look what
yes.
I'm doing. Look what I try to
yes.
do.
Yes. The reason he struck me is because he was trying to really have the government listen to something that, to me, you know, it wasn't just blowing the whistle on what Madoff was doing, but it was also calling out our government and calling out these organizations that are here to protect us from for not doing their jobs. And
you include the media in that, don't you?
I do. I think the media has a tendency to put a focus. You know, there's a famous saying that says, if it bleeds, it leads. The media likes to hear what's wrong. It's where all the attention gets focused. And I thought, you know, why do we know Bernie Madoff's name, but we don't know Frank Casey's name? That seems to be incongruent. We should know Frank Casey's name if we know the bad guy's name. We should know the good guy's name.
And Frank Casey found you, didn't he, when you posted something on a website or something?
Alborn Village is a finance website, and I posted that I was looking for conscious financiers. He reached out to me. He's the only one who reached out to me.
Out of the whole group?
Out of the whole group. I found everybody else. He found me on that, contacted me, said, hey, I don't know if I qualify, but, you know,
Frank Casey trying to take on Bernie Madoff, right? Yeah, that's all.
I was like, no, I think you qualify, Frank.
To those of you who just tuned in, a reminder, you're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 and WBGO.org. These are autobiographies of people whose lives and ideas we believe are on the cutting edge. One of those people happens to be Kim Ann Curtin, Wall Street coach and now new author, who is trying to launch a campaign to highlight the best people in the financial district. And she just named Frank Casey as one of them. One of the things I found interesting was a dedication, this is really unusual, to a Monsignor by the name of Thomas J. Hartman out in Long Island. And you said, without your love, support, and encouragement, I simply would not be here. What is that all about?
This amazing man, Father Tom, known to the world mostly as Father Tom, was famous in the early 80s for being part of what was known as the God Squad. He and Rabbi Mark Schulman used to be known as the God Squad, and they went on Good Morning America. They were really working at being ecumenical to teach people that you could be friends, you know, a Catholic priest could be friends with a Jewish rabbi. And they were hoping to kind of really bridge the two faiths. So
How'd they do?
They did really well. They were on Imus in the Morning like all the time. And, you know, they were always being covered about how both faiths can be friends. You don't have to, you know, you can be coming from different perspectives spiritually and still find common ground. They were best of friends. And I started to do producing for Father Tom when I was working at the time in some bookstores. And he was extremely open-minded and extremely thoughtful and incredibly sensitive to issues. He wasn't your typical Catholic priest. He had a caring and a love that just knew no bounds, and he's just an amazing man.
You went to see him because, you felt this connection to him because of something in your life, or
because of just challenges I was going through personally, and my family was going through personally. He was there as really a confidant and somebody who just was a rock of Gibraltar for me to navigate through really big challenges that I was going through, and that is part of what that dedication is. But even more, what that dedication is when I first started my business, I had, you know, we all have the temptation, right? So 3 months into my business, I got the temptation. And a headhunter that knew me very well, knew the salary I had walked away with, called me with the perfect dream job that any executive assistant would have wanted. And it was incredible salary. It was incredible, you know, fly around the world on a private jet, be a chief of staff, handle an art collection. I love art. It was just everything anybody could have ever wanted. But I had just started my business and I was so torn. I thought, my God, am I irresponsible for not taking this opportunity? But everything inside of me wanted to do my coaching business. I felt this was what I was here to do. And I called Father Tom and I was just broken up inside, crying. I was like, what do I do? What do I do? And he spoke some amazing words to me and said, you know, Kim, there are very few pioneers in this world. And he said, I think you're a pioneer. So I think you should just keep doing what you're doing. And I was like, that's what I wanted to hear. That's what I wanted to do. But I was afraid to listen to that voice. So if it wasn't for him and that conversation, you know, all of the things that have happened since may not have happened.
So the Wall Street coach got a life coach.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And all the best coaches really should have one. I have a coach. I've been working with a coach always. I think to be an effective coach, you need to be willing to have been with what's hard to be with. You need to go places within yourself because you're going to accompany other people on their journeys. And if you are not willing to go to some, I call it the dark basement of your own soul, how can you accompany somebody else to
that place? And you're trying to educate people to maybe re-educate them, in your view, people like Ayn Rand and Adam Smith. Right? You're smiling.
Yes. Adam Smith.
Here you go.
Adam Smith and Ayn Rand, I believe, have been short shrifted by a lot of different people. And I don't want to position myself so much as a defender of them, but what I'd like to position myself as is somebody who was enriched by them. The perspective, let me just take on Adam Smith right now, is that he is an advocate of self-interest only, that he is somebody that advocates you just do what you have to do and the hell with everybody else. And that is not, he was a moral philosopher. The book that I read of his that really impacted me was a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was written prior to The Wealth of Nations and is actually the umbrella.
The Wealth of Nations is the book that we all get in Economics 101.
Yes, which I did not take.
I did.
Well,
I don't remember anything. I got to tell you, that was just too hard.
Didn't you walk away thinking, though, that Adam Smith was a guy that advocated self-interest?
I got a C+, I think.
All right. Well, maybe you didn't walk away with that. So lucky for you, you got a C+, because then you didn't get, indoctrinated with misinformation.
Well, I think a lot of people don't understand Wall Street. I know you're trying to clear that up. It's hard. How about Ayn Rand?
Atlas Shrugged, one of my favorite books. What I feel, Ayn Rand is talking about is it's not selfishness as the way the world sees selfishness. I always found her philosophy was really an advocacy of being willing to take responsibility for what shows up in your life and for not selling out when you feel your core soul is calling you to stay true to something. The characters, that her novels impacted me were, there's this great scene in The Fountainhead. They did make that book of hers into a movie. And in it, of course, Gary Cooper plays this character, Howard Roark. And Howard Roark basically is challenged to dumb down his architecture, to make it appeal to the masses. And Howard Roark is sitting outside of the building that he didn't get because he wouldn't compromise and sell out what he felt was the vision of this building. And this man who in the media was trying to destroy his reputation is standing at the site of this building, and Roark is standing there, and Dewey walks over to Roark and he says, "Just look at this site, Roark, and seeing me, what do you think of me?" And just this poignant scene, and Howard Roark looks at him and he says, "I don't think of you." And in that moment, I just remember as a young girl, I thought, oh my God, if I wish I could be like that, that Howard Roark in that moment is saying, he's saying to Dewey, you have tried to ruin me, but it's not impacting me because I know who I am. I don't need you to know who I am for me to know who I am. And that to me is what builds the kind of life that can change the world. You have to know who you are if you're going to live in Wall Street or on Main Street. As a person of character in this world, you have to have the courage of your own convictions. You have to be self-aware. You have to know what you're going to stand for and what you're not going to stand for. And that's what I got from Ayn Rand. She was teaching me to have the courage of my own conviction.
But most people would disagree with you, wouldn't they, these days?
I think most people would, but I don't know
why. That
I think it's because they haven't read her own work, and I think it's also because people are hearing about people who are advocating being self-absorbed or being only concerned about themselves, and I just did not feel that that's what she was advocating.
Okay, one last word. What do you want people to do? Because we have about a minute left.
Okay.
Can you do it?
I'll try.
Good.
I want people to be inspired that if they are a man or woman of integrity and they work on Wall Street, that they know that they're not alone and that they are the majority. And if they realize they are the majority, they're going to be a lot more outspoken and they're going to challenge the leadership of their organizations to not do business as usual, to be more the kind of companies they could be proud of. I also wanted to really transform those people to become more outspoken and stronger so that they can push out the ones who are not of integrity, the ones who are not conscious. And I want people to become more self-aware, because I think if we focus on ourselves and become as much more enlightened, we can have a bigger impact on the people around us.
Well, I'm sure that our listeners wish you all the best with your project. Being a life coach and a coach who convinced people to do this is much worse than being coach of the New York Jets, who always lose. The folks who make our program accountable are Joanna Wolper, our senior producer, Doug Doyle, who's executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer, and Gabrielle Gerwitz is our web associate. For those of you who want to listen to any one of our more than 85 audiobiographies, just Google Conversations with Alan Wolper, and you will be immediately sent to our 24-hour on-demand page. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Wolper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District, and support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.